Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Don DeBar. Don is a longtime activist and journalist. He's a former Pacific Radio WBAI news editor. He currently hosts the CPR morning program. Oh, he contributes often on many issues. He writes like I do. We're both contributing to a book on Libya that should be out before very long. So much going on. Don, we had, shall we say, snafus two previous times. You never know when fate is going to intervene, and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's
you know,
right.
It's like a storm coming over the horizon. I mean a nasty one. I mean, what are you going to do?
You go
into the bomb shelter or whatever,
just hunker down
and wait for it to pass. Welcome, Don.
Let me
point you in whatever direction you want to go in first. There's so much going on at home and abroad. Shoot, you lead and I'll follow.
Ooh, let's see. Let's take a look at what's in the news today jump-off point. I'm looking at the L.A. Times, and the lead story there is that one in three L.A. County home mortgages is underwater. A third of the mortgages in Los Angeles secure loans where the security is worth less than the indebtedness, or the people owe more than the house is worth. That's a third of LA, and if you think about what the numbers are, even with an average loan of say $200,000 outstanding, and what the population of Los Angeles is, $3-5 million, So take a third of that for how many homes, housing units there are, and then take a third of that, and that's how much exposure there is times 200,000 the banking industry has in Los Angeles. In other words, trillions of dollars. And there's 3.8 million people in L.A., so figure about a million homes at $200,000, so that would be $200 billion of unsecured loans just in one city. Now run that across the country, and five cities, you're in the trillions already.
It's shocking. It's one of many shocking stories, Don.
Yeah.
I covered the mortgage debacle in my book that came out last year, How Wall Street Fleeces America. I mean, this stuff was all manufactured to happen. And, the homeowners take it in the ear. The bankers get off with a mild touch on the wrist. I mean, it's shocking and it's disgusting.
And these a big check. They don't just get a slap on the wrist. They get a big check put in their hand too.
That's
really galling.
Indeed. I mean, a feather touch, a slap on the wrist. I mean, you can't even call it a slap. They basically get licensed to go out and steal again. And the housing thing is only one element of what they're involved in. This gross speculation, where they literally make risk-free bets, because win they win and lose we lose.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's the way the deal is. They get in trouble. We pay for it. What kind of a system is that?
It's one that is weighted in favor of one class of people with a very small membership, and against another class, which is the rest of us. That's the 99% that the Occupy Wall Street people talk about. The system is designed to extract value in favor of a small class of people from the bulk of the population, and that's about the only thing that it does efficiently. It doesn't do much else efficiently, but it does do that.
Oh, it is very skilled at grand theft. That's the business model, Don.
That's right. Exactly right. So, it seems to me that whatever else is going on anywhere, job one is to try to solve that problem, because that's the thing that, to the extent that humanity is going to have a future, we're going to have to solve that problem pretty soon, because all of the other things, the environmental catastrophes that await us, the social, sociological, and economic catastrophes that are either underway or await us. All those things rest on this system of extracting value from the population in favor of a small group of people. And until we solve that dynamic, basically, and correct the direction of activity among the human population, we are doomed. That's my personal opinion, but it seems objectively it's hard to argue with it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we have a terrible situation on our hands when the government, instead of working for all of us to try to have a an equitable situation and literally actually spend more time helping people most in need, we find exactly the opposite going on. The people who cause the problems get rewarded, and the people who suffer for them get punished more. And at the end of this year, Don, there is a package already agreed to by Democrats and Republicans. I believe the time frame is about 10 years, but it's with all the austerity that's been foisted on people so far, there's a $4 trillion package on the table that will kick in after the election. Nobody wants to mess around and lose voters by announcing we're going to cut this, that, and everything else. Tell people are going to lose their food stamps, and Obama loses votes in return.
Sure,
so,
of course.
So this is all agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep it quiet, and then the trap is sprung after the November elections. And again, $4 trillion, I think, is just for starters.
Yep.
I mean, over a 10-year period with what they have in mind, it may end up being $8 trillion, $10 trillion, and we still don't know how many trillions have been stolen and given to the bankers. I think officially we know about $9
trillion. Yeah.
I think it could be two or three times that amount.
Yeah, and when you're working with numbers like that, you're talking about the baseline being very elastic, because as you increase the money supply dramatically, you change the value of both the existing money and the money being printed, and you have to start looking at aggregations of those funds in terms of their concentration. In other words, what is the share that this represents of the total currency? And even as what money we have left is being diluted, the percentage of funds that are held by these small groups of people, the percentage of all money is shifting in their favor. An example: if there are $10, in the entire universe outstanding today, and I have five of them, and you have five of them, then we share half each of the money. If we print another $100 and give that to you, you now have 105 of the 110, and I have five. And if you now reapply that money to actual economic activity, in other words, before the total economy was worth $10, because that's how much money was printed, now that same economy, there's no different economic activity going on, but that same economy is now worth $110, and I only own $5 of it, you have diluted the value of my savings. And that's a dynamic that's going on that's invisible to a lot of people. It becomes visible somewhat as you look at the inflation of commodities, the inflated prices of gasoline, food, all these things that we're seeing shift upwards. You can see part of that activity, part of the consequence of that, activity. But also, even worse than that, because there are things that mitigate that. So, you have the appearance of the thing and the actual thing. As they extract more and more value from the labor of people in China, for example, and so I'm buying more and more things that are produced by low wage, whether it's in China or elsewhere, by low wage workers, I don't see everything appreciating to really reflect what the declining value of my currency is, because it still costs $400 for a computer or whatever. The reason for that is it now costs them what used to be 2 cents to produce the computer, because that's what they're paying the person. But I'm saying, gee, I see the meat going up to $9 a pound, but the computer's still $400. There's a point in time where there's a diminishing return where they can't extract more value from low-wage workers or whatever, and then there'll be a full expression of the phenomenon that's going on with the currency. So at some point in time, my several years worth of salary that are constituting my savings, you know, will end up being worth enough to buy a loaf of bread, literally. And that phenomenon is something that's underway, and it's only a small part of the total picture. Another part is what happened in the mortgage market, where from the late 70s, where you had people at one point in time, homeowners had less than 65% of the value of their homes, and the value of their homes was increasing while their debt was declining. That reversed in like 1979, 1980, and the banking industry and Wall Street basically began at that time to start capturing a larger and larger share of the equity in the housing and other real estate in the United States, to where now, you know, as we just explained in L.A., you're looking at they actually own more of the house than exists.
and nobody really knows who owns the mortgages. So way
right.
back when I took out my last mortgage in 1973, you went to a mortgage lender, which I did, and you got a mortgage. It was a local bank,
right.
a modest-sized one, and I knew who my mortgage holder was. I dealt with one organization, and today they slice and dice these mortgages into I don't know how many pieces, tranches, and they get repackaged as mortgage-backed securities. And if you want to go find out who is your mortgage holder, you can't do it because it could be 20 or maybe 120 or maybe many more times that number. There is no way to put your finger on one and say, I have this issue I want to discuss. May I discuss it with somebody in your organization? That doesn't work anymore.
Right.
The system is corrupted and broken, Don.
Yep. It's cute, that particular condition, the what's called MERS, M-E-R-S, or Mortgage Electronic Registration Service, was a creature of the 1990s, the Clinton administration, when the market in real estate mortgages, home mortgages, became so liquid. They wanted to be able to just swap this paper and move it around and, you know, speculate on it at will, which was a relatively new phenomenon. It hadn't happened since the 1920s in this country up until, say, the Reagan era. It started in earnest. It began in the Clinton years. There was a long practice that went back to England, where the ownership of a mortgage, you know, in other words, who holds the indebtedness, who has a lien on the property, was a matter of public record in the county clerk or city register's office, so that anyone, the public, could go and look at the condition of title to a piece of property and say, okay, the interests are held by the owners of the deed, John and Mary Smith or whomever, and the lender and the other lien holders. And to change that, as the banks would occasionally sell parts or all of their loan portfolio, they would file a document called an assignment of mortgage in the county clerk's office that would say, Chase Manhattan Bank, who formerly held this mortgage worth $82,500 as of June 1st, 1980, hereby sells or conveys that mortgage to a Marine Midland Bank. And so now you know the holder of the loan is, and of the lien, is Marine Midland Bank. Well, that became too cumbersome for the new creature that they were creating of this speculation in home mortgages. And so what they did, in essence, was create, after, I don't know, 300, 400, 500 years of this practice in English law and American law, create a private record of ownership of these things, and rather than having to file an instrument, they would do nothing but contact the owner, on occasion not doing it, and say, you don't write the check to Chase anymore, now you're writing it to Bank of America or whatever. Well, aside from all of the other unintended or not consequences that everyone who did any kind of commerce or anything else, like having a place to live that rested on a system that was several hundred years old, suddenly being upended, the other thing that had to happen as a consequence of that was a major change in the legal system that happened without a single piece of legislation or any real precedent court case. And that was where before, you can step out for a second, when you went to the corner bank to get the mortgage like you were talking about before, they kept the mortgage in a file cabinet in their office. And if you stopped paying on your mortgage, they brought that mortgage down to the courthouse and said, "Judge, here, I have a mortgage, my bank has a mortgage on this house. Here's the note the guy signed promising to pay it back. He hasn't paid it back. We want to start a foreclosure proceeding and have the property sold so that we can get the money that we're owed paid back to us." And so one of the fundamental building blocks of being able to make your case was to prove that you had the right to do so, that you hold a mortgage on the property, and so you would produce it at the closing. When Wall Street took over and they turned it into this whole liquid, you know, mortgage-backed securities speculative, you know, construct, no one could ever put their fingers on the paper anymore. And so they would just go into court and say, "Well, we have a mortgage on this property," and not actually have to prove it. Well, obviously, and the courts began to accept this. This happened beginning in the mid-1990s. The first real foreclosures under the new MERS system started taking place, like 96, 97, 98, and then swelling from there. And so the courts just adjusted their practice, where they stopped requiring people to come in and prove first that they held the mortgage before they began an action to foreclose it. And the abuses that followed from that, I mean, you know, some of the things we've read in the paper and, you know, we've heard about robo-signing and all this, but on a daily basis, the abuses are such that you would have people thrown out of their homes and the homes sold. They don't get a dime out of it, even though if I'm owed $100,000, your house is worth $200,000, it's sold at auction for $175,000. I'm only entitled to what I was owed, and you're supposed to get the rest. That money started evaporating and disappearing, and everybody involved trying to grab a piece of it. And after rendering whole groups of people destitute and homeless around the country, they also essentially corrupted the court system so much. See, the thing that's really difficult for me to communicate is the importance of the issue of standing. And if you try to sue because there's a nuclear power plant leaking this nasty stuff into the environment, or if you try to sue because your school district is doing some horrible thing to all the kids, the courts will not allow you to come in as a private citizen unless you can prove that you're impact, the impact you're suffering, is different from the impact suffered by everyone else. You have a diverse interest in the case from that of the general public. And they call that the issue of standing. You have to prove that you're suffering an injury. And first, you have to prove that you have an actual stake in something. Well, that's to do esoteric litigation, and you have this bar. Yet, things that affect people's homes, where forever, up until the 1990s, under our law, that the person that would seek to throw you out of your house and have it sold to pay them off had to go in with the actual documents and show it. About 15 years ago, the courts stopped requiring that, and then millions were foreclosed under that. That's the thing that's in the media the last couple of years, that you're getting a little pushback from some people in the court system and even a few legislators, but it's still a huge change in the law that was never legislated and that has impacted more people, I think, than any single law passed since maybe the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the mid-60s.
And again, most people don't understand this, Don. I'd love to keep going for the rest of the program on this one topic alone.
Yeah.
In the little time we have left to the bottom of the hour, let's shift overseas. This morning, I am writing about the so-called P5 plus one talks going on in Baghdad, the
right.
Iranian nuclear talks. And I got an email from Press TV asking me to go on a program Sunday discussing this very topic. Well, I'd be delighted to do it. I've written about it before a couple of times. I write about Iran very, very often and all this stuff going on. And I've said categorically that there is no evidence whatever that Iran has anything other than a legitimate, peaceful nuclear program. And I'm not the one to say it. I'm not a nuclear expert. IAEA inspectors say it. U.S. intelligence that's been surveilling Iran in all kinds of ways, on the ground, by satellite, probably internal spies. I mean, you name it.
Right.
And they've been watching Iran for years. And the latest U.S. intelligence report, the assessment of 16 U.S. intelligence agencies as of March this year, is there is no evidence whatever that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. It doesn't
right.
mean that they're not doing it. It means that we can't find it. They can't find anything to
right.
show Iran is doing this. And yet they're going through these hijinks and these nuclear talks. There were earlier ones, at least going back to 2006. There were more in 2009. In April this year, there was a round in Istanbul. There's a Baghdad round going on now. And the demands placed on Iran are absolutely unreasonable. No sovereign country should go along with them. And I'm virtually sure Iran will not.
Right. You know, I mean, they've been waving this, they meaning the United States and some of its allies, have been waving this threat around for years. I remember interviewing Daniel Ellsberg back in 2007, I think. At the time, we were, you know, on the brink of, you know, if you were going to follow the public statements coming out of Washington, on the brink of an attack on Iran then over this alleged nuclear weapons program. And the thing, you know, start at the beginning of that. If there was ever a case of the pot calling the kettle black, the United States has more nuclear weapons than everyone else in the world combined, including the Russians. And the United States is the only country in the world that has ever used them. And yet, this whole, you know, scenario of Iran allegedly looking at some point in the future at acquiring nuclear weapons is, you know, a cause to go to war, to hear just about anyone in Congress and everyone involved in the White House, State Department, et cetera. You know, that's what they've been saying since the Bush administration, this is what we, you know, have to put up with. The history of the United States with Iran, going back to Mossadegh and the Shah and all of that, itself should militate towards the U.S. helping to reconstruct that country, let alone stopping, threatening, blowing it into oblivion, you know, every other week. And, you know, to anyone paying attention, the reasons for this are clear. This is basic, fundamental geopolitical power games. Iran has a relatively independent foreign policy. It has relatively independent relations with several of the people in the, you know, several of the other nations in the region. It is a rather, you know, healthy economy. It has its own policy for energy, and it sets its own prices for its natural resources. You know, these are all things, of course, that are incompatible with an imperial design for relations with other countries, whether economic or political. And so the United States has been involved since the revolution in 1979, and since we were looking at, you know, photocopied pictures of Ayatollah Khomeini with targets on him and Bomb Iran taped to the back of every merchant store on any given Main Street in the country. You know, we're talking now, that was, what, 35 years ago or 33 years ago. You know, we've been saying we're going to blow Iran up since their revolution. And this is, you know, one additional step in that. Then the context is, look, do what we're telling you, or we're going to blow you up. That's the basic relationship between the United States and Iran. These talks now are constructive, more constructive than going to war. However, you know, the end game is really going to be what determines whether this was constructive or not, because if it ends up being part of an argument that enables a war at some point, you know, whether it's an October surprise for Obama or a January surprise for Obama or Romney or, you know, whatever, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. And although Iran said yesterday that they expect a positive result from the P5 plus one talks in Baghdad, their expectation, unfortunately, doesn't carry much weight with the likes of Clinton and Obama and the people they work for.
Oh, well, they accomplished nothing yesterday. They continued again today. The demands, I have just begun the article that I'm writing, Don. And the information on the proposals on both sides, there was the P5 plus one proposal, which is mainly a Washington one.
Right.
Iran had its own counterproposal.
Right.
With nothing much in the way of details listed, especially on the Iranian side, there was only one thing that I found so far. I went to the FARS news agency site, and
right.
it mentioned that Iran submitted a five-point program, but it
right.
didn't say what's in it. I don't know
part
why
of what's
in
it.
What's
I've
in
heard,
it.
What, part of what I've heard is in it. I think I heard it from Russian TV. I don't remember, but is setting a threshold on the you know, the level of enrichment of the products at their reactor.
Oh, well, Iran wants 20%.
Right.
20% is needed, by the way, and again, I'm no nuclear expert. 20% is needed to produce medical isotopes, and that is a legitimate need that a country like Iran and others have. You can't
right.
ask them to give that up. They need to do that. Weapons grade needs almost 90%
right.
enrichment. You never hear that in the U.S. media.
Of course not. Right. But, you know, again, when you're looking at monopoly capitalism, you can't tell if you're the person that's manufacturing medical radioisotopes and someone else is charting an independent course to produce their own. If you have the power to stop them, and, you know, these are the games you play to exercise that power, then that's what you do. And that may well be what's being done. Just the last point on that, I see we're getting close to the end, is they have been conducting bilateral, you know, separate bilateral conversation with China. And that is promising. The situation that existed in the world before, where you had a bipolar world, so-called, with the United States and the Soviet Union, was much better for third parties, third world nations and others, than a monopolar world, because if you weren't getting what you wanted out of a discussion with the United States, you could then have a discussion with the Soviet Union. You had some leverage for your own sovereignty, even. And with China emerging and starting to take a little more assertive role in the world, regardless of their intentions, just the fact of the existence of another place to go for some of these countries that are used to diktat from the United States, I think it's a constructive thing. And it's being exercised, I think, here in this discussion about Iran's nuclear capacity.
Well, China and Russia may be our best hope, Don.
Yep.
Literally, two countries that can say no to Washington and get away with it.
Yep.
And they both have, China has the economic clout. They both have the military clout, especially Russia with its nuclear arsenal. I've quoted Helen Caldicott in one of her books. The book came out a few years ago. But she said between Russia and America, they have 97% of the world's nuclear weapons. You know, Israel might have 200 or 400, who knows, in the hundreds. And Washington has them in the many thousands. And even the official numbers, who knows what they really have, because they lie. They don't say anything.
Right.
And I can't imagine, again, we're nearly out of time. I can't imagine America wants a confrontation with either country, but there's
right.
no question that the ultimate red lines, Iran is just a way station on the way to eliminating the Chinese and the Russian rivals, but doing it by war, I just can't imagine any leader insane enough to want to do something like that. But you never know. There've been some lunatics running around this country, and we could get one who literally wants to give it a shot and see if we can do it.
I hear that. Yeah, you know, but they do own a lot now, China, including a lot of things here. So that's another monkey wrench in the works. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Oh, indeed so, Don. We are at the bottom of the hour. The time goes by too fast.
Sure
and
does.
If we went on for another hour and a half or 2 hours, we would still end up saying, my God, there's so much more to talk about, but I want to get you back. I'm going to shoot you an email.
Great.
I feel awful about the two snafus that messed us both up. But, you know, those things happen. What are you going to do?
Absolutely.
So we connected today. Thank heavens.
Yes. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it a lot. I appreciate all the work you do.
Oh, indeed. So let me sign off and just tell my listeners that, of course, we're on every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time and on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And I always say, make it a regular habit.